From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Inequality in America, already sky high before the coronavirus hit, has been greatly exacerbated by the pandemic. But understanding poverty in the world's richest nation has always been a challenge. Media narratives and politicians' rhetoric fuels the perception that poverty is what someone else experiences. But in fact, poverty is widespread in America and affects nearly everyone at some point in their lives. Understanding poverty, who it affects, how it can be addressed, what works and what doesn't, is critical to fixing the nation's deep economic inequality. My guest and author has launched an ambitious effort to that end. Mark Rank is the Herbert S. Hadley Professor of Social Welfare at Washington University in St. Louis. He's widely recognized as one of the foremost experts and speakers in the country on issues of inequality, poverty, and social justice. He's written numerous books and also created a website called Confronting Poverty. He now joins me to discuss his latest book, co-authored with Lawrence Eppert and Heather Bullock, called Poorly Understood: What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thanks, Sonali. Great to be with you.
So let's talk about how widespread poverty first is. As I mentioned, it's often seen as something that happens to someone else. But in fact, most of us in America, unless we're born into, you know, massive independent wealth, experience poverty at some point in our lives. So how do you explain how widespread it is?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. And that's where we start in the book, is this question of what's the likelihood across an American's life of experiencing poverty. We often, when we talk about poverty, we often speak of how many folks are poor in a given year. But this is a different way of looking at it. So if we look, for example, between the ages of 20 and 75, what we find is that 60% of the American population will experience at least 1 year below the official poverty line. And three quarters of Americans will experience either poverty or very near poverty. So poverty is something that touches the vast majority of Americans. And I think a lot of people would be surprised by that.
And when you say poverty, we're talking about what exactly? The ability to, you know, put gas in the tank, or the ability to make your next bill payment. You might be asset rich, but cash poor.
Yeah, so the way that we define poverty in the United States, the way the Census Bureau does, is to say if you fall below a certain income level, we're going to count you as in poverty. And if you fall above that level, we're not going to count you as in poverty. So for a household of three persons last year, the poverty line was around $20,000. So if that family earned less than $20,000 for the year, they would be counted as in poverty. But one thing I should point out is that that represents poverty at its most opulent level. In other words, if you're a dollar over that, you're not counted as in poverty. Hmm. It turns out that 45% of all folks in poverty in the United States actually fall below half the poverty line. So instead of a family of three trying to get by on $20,000, imagine a family of three trying to get by on $10,000.
Wow. So let's talk about who exactly are America's poor. If you watch a lot of Fox News, poverty is rampant in urban centers, which is, of course, code for where Black and brown people live. Is that true?
So the way to think about this is that the reach of poverty is really wide. It touches all aspects of American society. So let's take that sort of image that a lot of people have, which is poverty is really confined to inner city areas and folks of color. It turns out that only about 10 to 15% of people that are currently in poverty actually live in high poverty neighborhoods. Today in the United States, there are more people living in poverty in suburban areas than in central cities. And some of the most deep-seated poverty in the United States is actually found in rural America. So if you look at Appalachia, or you look at the Deep South and the Mississippi Delta, or American Indian reservations, there you find extreme levels of poverty. So I think the way to think about this is that poverty is not confined to just one specific area. You can really go down almost any street or any block in any American city or location and find somebody that's probably in poverty.
Is there a reluctance on the part of Americans to admit that they have experienced or are experiencing poverty? And is that part of the problem of overcoming this?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean,
there's shame.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say the shame of poverty or of using a safety net program, or we might think of it as a stigma. These are groups that are highly stigmatized. Now, why is that? One of the reasons is because of the way that we have typically understood poverty in this country, and that is as an individual failing, that people aren't working hard enough, they've made bad decisions, they haven't gotten enough skills, that there's something wrong with the individual, and that's why poverty exists. And what we argue in the book is that really the reason for poverty and the reason for why it's so high in the United States is it's a structural failing. It's a failing of the economy, and it's a failing of the policy and political environments to really address the issue of poverty.
Let's talk about how long Americans might experience poverty at a time, what you call in your book, poverty spells, because it isn't that, a household or an individual might be poor all their lives. They might experience it in short spells. They might experience poverty and then not, and then experience it again. What do we know about how often and for how long people experience poverty?
Yeah, I was just talking this morning to somebody about this. And, you know, we often use the phrase poor people, but that's really, that's not correct. Because as you're pointing out here, most people move in and out of poverty. So they're not poor people their whole lives. So the typical spell of folks in poverty is maybe for 1 or 2 years. They then get somewhat above the poverty line. And then something may happen to them down the road, which throws them back into poverty. So the way to think about this is that poverty is really quite fluid. Sure, there is a group of folks that are in poverty for long periods of time, but that's only about maybe 10% of the entire population of individuals that will experience poverty. So the way to think about it is much more fluid. And what happens, and this gets back to what we were talking about in terms of the long-term risk, over time, things occur to people that they didn't anticipate. So losing a job, a pandemic occurs, people get sick, a family splits up. All of those things have the potential to throw folks into poverty. They're there for a relatively short period of time, get back on their feet, but then something else might happen to them. So it's a much more fluid kind of picture.
Let's go back to talking about the racial breakdown of who is poor or who experiences poverty in America. You mentioned that suburban areas and rural areas is where you have rampant poverty. And these are, of course, where there's majority white populations. And indeed, the majority of American poor are whites, even if the percentage in terms of racial category of people who experience the most poverty is African American. So larger percentage of African Americans among African Americans experiencing poverty, but overall numbers, because whites are still the majority ethnic and racial group in this country, the largest group of poor people in this country is white. Is this important to understand these distinctions?
Yeah, because I think it gets at this idea of the way that we've sort of framed poverty is, as I just said, you know, as an individual failing. But another way that we framed it is that it's an issue of them and not an issue of us. And what we need to think about is what I was saying before, that is, the reach of poverty is really wide. So what you're pointing out is absolutely correct. The largest group in terms of numbers in poverty are whites. But on the other hand, folks of color are certainly at a much higher risk of experiencing poverty. Both of those things are correct, and we need to keep them both in mind because they're both important. But again, I think that the image that we so often have in this country is, oh, poverty is something that happens to some other group and not to me or not to my group. And it turns out that that's really incorrect, that poverty should be thought of as an issue of us and not an issue of them.
And just to sort of maybe express that a little bit better, if you're white in America, you're the least likely to experience poverty. But if you are a poor person in America, you're the most likely to be white.
Yes. Yeah. That's another way to. Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. Absolutely. But on the other hand, absolutely correct. But it's also that. For the life course work that I did, looking at the overall risk across a person's adulthood of experiencing poverty, for Black Americans, that figure was close to 90%. So at some point in time, for African Americans, 90% would experience poverty.
Wow.
But for white Americans, the figure was slightly over 50%. So this isn't a small minority. Even for white Americans, a majority of them will experience poverty.
Let's talk about government welfare, which unfortunately after Reagan and after Clinton, that word itself became demonized. And if you talk to Republicans, we have far too many government handouts going to poor people in America, which is a disincentive to work, et cetera, fueling this logic that people are poor of their own volition and that giving them help actually makes them less likely to emerge from poverty. But how strong is a social safety net? How serious is American welfare? American welfare state? Is it a strong welfare state? And you know, maybe we shouldn't include the American Rescue Plan that just passed, which some are saying is the biggest expansion of government welfare in decades.
Yeah. So the safety net or social welfare state in the United States is really, really weak. It is by far the weakest safety net of any of the kind of Western industrialized countries. And this is one reason why the United States has the highest rates of poverty among the high economy countries. So our rates of poverty, our depth of poverty, and the amount of inequality that we have in this country is far higher than any of these other countries. And the reason is, one of the reasons is, because we do so little to help people from getting into poverty. And what we basically do through our safety net is we punish people for going into poverty. We make these programs really, really difficult to get and to maintain. And that's by design. By design, we're making it difficult. And so, you know, the conservative argument that we spend all this money on welfare and these kind of programs is really, really bogus. The program that people often point to when they talk about welfare is the TANF program, which is designed largely for single moms with kids. That program is far less than 1% of the entire federal budget. So we're spending very, very little in terms of the social safety net.
There's also food stamps, which Americans rely on. That too, I understand, over the years has been decimated, or I guess it depends on who's in power and what the need is in the country at the time, right?
Yeah, it's it also, if you look at how much the average person gets from food stamps or the SNAP program, it's only a couple hundred dollars a month. And again, we make it really difficult for people to get those kind of programs.
Does government welfare work to address poverty when you have a robust welfare system? And maybe you can talk about some of the other nations where this is true. Is there a strong correlation between addressing poverty? Is it successful? Does it actually have outcomes that match its goals?
Yeah, really good question. So the answer is most definitely. And I can point to a couple ways of thinking about this. One is what you just said, and that is if we compare the United States with other countries that are much more proactive in terms of their social safety nets, they wind up having much less poverty than the United States. But we can look at the United States too in a couple of ways to show that actually safety net programs can have a dramatic effect. So let me give you one example. In 1959, the poverty rate for the elderly in the United States was around 35%. Today, the poverty rate for the elderly is around 9 or 10%. And the only reason for that has been the expansion of the Social Security program and the Medicare program. Those have had a dramatic effect on reducing poverty for the elderly. So if we didn't have those programs today, the poverty rate for the elderly, instead of 9%, would be closer to 40%. That's a clear example of government proactively reducing the rate of poverty. The other example I'd give, and one that conservatives really love to sort of use, Ronald Reagan was famous for saying, we fought a war on poverty and poverty won. It turns out that from 1959 to 1973, the rate of poverty in the United States was cut in half, from 22% to 11%. And there are two reasons for that. One, we had strong economic growth, but the other is we had an expansion of poverty programs through the war on poverty, and they dramatically reduced the extent of poverty. Was poverty eliminated? No, but it was dramatically reduced. So these are examples that show that government programs can actually have a quite an effective role to play in terms of reducing poverty.
Right. I mean, a lot of the narrative that Reagan fueled that continues today relied on racist tropes of, you know, the welfare queen, etc. So that certainly speaks to that sense of otherness, that poverty is something that those other people experience. And if they experience it, it is their fault. And if you give them help, they'll try to defraud you and take advantage of you and won't want to work. All of these build up this sense that we can't trust poor Americans to do the right thing if they're offered help. And that's a really self-defeating idea, you know, when we think about how many Americans, for example, who might be poor, who voted for Trump, although, of course, not all of Trump's voters were poor. But there is that terrible self-defeating misconception, right?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, everything that you said there is spot on. You know, we have this image that we've been talking about that these are folks that are abusing the system and so on and so forth. And really, what politicians have done, some politicians have done, have they have used these myths to their advantage. So at the kind of the end of the book, we ask this question of, okay, we go through all these different myths and show that there's really no evidence for any of them. Why do they continue? Why do these things continue? And one of the arguments we make is because they actually serve a function for some folks. Political actors have used this mythology of the poor over and over to score political points. And as you said, welfare and poverty are often used as code words for race and for Black. And politicians have used that over and over to score points. There's a great quote, I don't have it right here, but it's from Lyndon Johnson, who says, you know, if you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the best colored man, he won't mind you picking his pockets. And then he says, hell, give him somebody to look down on and he'll empty his pockets for you. And that's what we've been doing in this country over and over and over in terms of poverty and race. We've used race to divide poor whites and poor Blacks from seeing their common interests together.
One of the things that you point out in your book is that research has demonstrated that a number of poverty-stricken individuals and families who would be eligible for various safety net programs choose not to apply in order to avoid the humiliation, frustration, and stigma associated with welfare. Rather than encouraging fraud, the system would appear to be encouraging non-participation instead. This sounds to me also like self-loathing, not just otherizing poverty, but a sense of self-loathing.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what we're doing is rather than fraud in the system, what it's set up to do is basically prevent people from applying for these programs. And so we really need to get over this whole mindset. Another I think really important point here that's connected to this is the question of what does poverty cost us as a society? What is the economic cost to the United States? And I did an analysis a couple of years ago. And what we did is we estimated what childhood poverty does in terms of increasing our healthcare costs, because we know that poverty is associated with higher healthcare costs. What's it associated in terms of less economic productivity, because as children become adults, they're less economically productive, and the cost of childhood poverty in terms of higher criminal justice costs. And we factored those all in, came up with a conservative number that childhood poverty costs the United States on an annual basis slightly over $1 trillion. Put that in perspective, that was about 28% of the entire federal budget. Hmm. So here's the deal. We can either pay for the problem on the back end, or we can pay for it on the front end. And whenever you pay for a problem on the back end, it's always much more expensive than preventing the problem in the first place. The other thing that we show is that for every dollar we spend reducing childhood poverty, we would save $7 to $12 down the road. So the point of all of this is to say, not only is reducing childhood poverty the morally right thing to do, but it's also economically the smart thing to do as well.
You mentioned healthcare. So let's talk about what are some of those simple solutions. I imagine a nationalized health plan would go a long way toward providing a social safety net for all Americans, strengthening existing programs like SNAP and TANF. What else? How would you, if you were to give advice on these seemingly pretty obvious solutions to addressing inequality, what would you tell politicians who claim to care about eradicating inequality?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, in some ways, the hard part is not what the solutions are. The hard part is really having the political will to institute these solutions. So the things that you just mentioned, universal health care, every other country, every other industrialized country provides this except for the United States. That's clearly important. Making childcare accessible and affordable, affordable housing, all of those kinds of things. Another thing that I would say that actually is in the news and will continue to be in the news is the idea of creating jobs that pay a decent wage. So, you know, right now the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, hasn't been raised since 2009. It's impossible if you're working full time on that to not be in poverty. And as President Biden says, there's something wrong that if folks are working full time, they really shouldn't fall into poverty. So raising the minimum wage up to more of a livable wage, I think, would be very positive. There's talk now about things like a child allowance, which would help folks who have kids raising those children. So every month you might get some kind of a monthly cash benefit.
Right. There's in the American Rescue Plan a pretty strong expansion of child tax credits, which, you know, I suppose you and others would hope would become permanent, because it is currently temporary, but it could go such a long way towards actually putting cash in the hands of lower income families with children.
Yeah, and this is an idea that European countries have had for decades. So this isn't anything new. They've been doing this for a long period of time. But the fact that we're talking about it and actually instituted for a year this kind of policy is actually pretty remarkable. And so in some ways, I'm actually kind of guardedly optimistic that we're beginning to talk about, again, think about it as dealing with poverty on the structural level rather than on the individual. I use the example of musical chairs, and I won't go into all the detail, but what we have done is we focus all our attention on who loses out at the game rather than why the game produces losers in the first place. And what we need to do is change the structure of the game so that there are fewer losers in the first place.
Finally, what do you think needs to happen to address the sort of culture war around poverty that you do talk about and that we've discussed, that sense of shame, that refusal to acknowledge that there is class in America and strong class differences, and there is a class war being waged against the poor by the rich, and that it's not something to be ashamed of to experience poverty. It seems as though obviously your book goes a long way toward addressing that. But unless your book is, you know, going to be covered by Fox News or properly addressed and properly read and explained by media narratives, or maybe, you know, have free copies distributed nationwide, how do we address these issues?
Well, you know, I mean, sometimes there are some folks that you're just never going to convince.
Yeah.
What we've tried to do here is to say, look, let's look at this clear-eyed from an objective point of view and show you what the reality is versus the myths. And there is absolutely no question that these myths do not stand up at all. But I think you've touched on this, and I think this is so important, that the moral ground for us to look at poverty in the United States is not one of individual blame. It should be one of moral outrage and injustice. That is, in a country with these resources and wealth, there is something fundamentally wrong and unfair about such a high percentage of the population being in poverty. We need to be outraged at that situation, rather than using that old trope of individual blame.
Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And actually, give out that website that you've also helped to create and how you think that can be a way for people to spread more information.
Yeah, so I have a website that actually is getting a lot of play. Folks come from all over the world. And you just type in confrontingpoverty.org. And what it does, there's a lot of really great information on there, but it has, I developed a poverty risk calculator. So you can go there, you put in some of your background characteristics, and you can see what your actual risk of poverty is in the next 5, 10, or 15 years. And if you do that, I'll bet you're going to be pretty surprised. So please make use of that. It's all free and accessible to anybody who wants to use it.
Confrontingpoverty.org again is that website, and we'll link to it. Mark, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks very much, Sonali. I enjoyed it.
My guest has been Mark Rank. He is the Herbert S. Hadley Professor of Social Welfare at Washington University in St. Louis and a widely recognized expert on issues of inequality, poverty, and social justice. We've been talking about his newest book, co-authored with Lawrence Eppard and Heather Bullock, called Poorly Understood: What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.